Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Know what causes heart disease? Think you do? Today's show will turn everything you think you understand about heart disease around. Maybe you're suspicious about the cholesterol connection, but do you know how deep the deception runs? It's almost as though conventional medicine doesn't really want people to be protected. Still, I bet you're scared. Most people are. Today's show should alter not only your fear, but your behavior. Join us for a discussion about the great cholesterol con with Dr. Malcolm Kenrick. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. Health comes from how each person's unique biology responds to its environment. As an example, an article to be published in the Public Library of Science Genetics argues that the environment can affect how genes actually operate. I don't mean mutations from toxins, I mean the response to geography and way of life. I think the salient question for us all is, what environments are healthy? How do I find them? How do I create them? I don't want to promote the tired view that your health is entirely up to you. We know enough about the social determinants of health to avoid that pit. Nevertheless, two news items last week turned my attention to the issue of how each person can adapt their personal environment for better health. The first item reported on yet another weight loss study. The newsworthy piece of this research was that people who were better at keeping a food diary tended to lose more weight. There were many things wrong with the design of the study, not least of which is the obsession with weight gain as a disease rather than a symptom of metabolic imbalances with its own causes that need attention, principally social and physiological stress. But that's another story. On its face, both the news and the research leads us to believe that keeping track of what you eat will help you change your eating pattern, a simple idea about how to change your personal environment. It sounded very appealing. I was immediately suspicious. I was reminded of the Hawthorne effect, well known in social research. It was discovered over 100 years ago. When researchers observed how people did their jobs, they noticed that their work performance improved. And when the observation stopped, work performance dropped back. The Hawthorne effect is now generalized to include any temporary change in a person's environment that elicits an equally temporary change in behavior. When the weight loss study ends, what happens to the food diaries? For the study, everyone was supposed to keep a diary. Some were more diligent than others. Those who were more diligent diarists lost more weight. Was it the diary, or the diligence, or something else that preceded both? This is an obvious demonstration of how different people learn things differently. Some people in the study took to the diary, some did not. For the people who didn't, what other method might have worked as well for them? In another study, researchers examined what might predict whether a child at 12 who doesn't smoke would become a smoker by 16. While acknowledging the effect of known factors, such as whether a parent smokes, a parent's approval of smoking, the child's awareness of cigarette advertising, and how adventuresome the child is, the researchers found that two things added to the risk of children becoming smokers: how easily the child thought they could get cigarettes, and whether they had friends who smoked. While the article discussed various public health policies for reducing these factors and their impact, what I wondered was what methods the children themselves could find to control their personal environment in order to avoid cigarette addiction. What these two studies tell me is that everyone needs some help in learning how to adapt their personal environment. Learning that is specific to each person, their circumstances, and their capacities and powers. Although affected by the social context created by commerce and public policy, it's possible for each of us to better understand the way in which we learn and the opportunities we have to create a better life. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Now to our show topic, which is heart disease, what's the real cause? And our guest, Dr. Malcolm Kenrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K, He is a family practitioner in the UK. He graduated from Aberdeen in Scotland. He has a particular interest in cardiology and writes for medical journals and magazines. Dr. Kendrick is an active cholesterol skeptic who believes the cholesterol has nothing to do with causing heart disease and wrote the Great Cholesterol Con. He lives near Manchester in the United Kingdom and is married with two children, and we're very honored to have you on the line with us. Welcome.
Hello there.
Hi. It's very clear when you read your book that the whole issue of what cholesterol is not at all clear. I mean, that there's a misconception about what cholesterol actually is. Do you want to start there?
Well, I think, the problem is the terminology appears to have been designed by a committee to make it impossible for the average human being to understand what anybody's talking about. Obviously, cholesterol is a chemical, which has a chemical structure, which I can't remember at the moment. But cholesterol it doesn't exist in your bloodstream because, like many fatty substances, it doesn't dissolve in water, therefore blood. So cholesterol is carried around in little taxis, if you like, little spheres that have different names. And horribly confusingly, the largest of which is called a chylomicron, and the smallest of which is called high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, which most people will have heard is good cholesterol. Of course, it's not cholesterol. It just contains cholesterol. Interestingly, of course, HDL has the highest concentration of cholesterol in it of any of the lipoproteins, and yet it's supposed to be good. So we have all this weird terminology. The other substance carried around in lipoproteins is triglyceride, which is three fats attached to a glycerol, tri and glyceride. But one of the lipoproteins is also known as a triglyceride, whereas actually it's a lipoprotein. So essentially, I spent quite a lot of the book trying to explain to people what on earth I was talking about when I was talking about things.
Well, what's interesting about it is when you do it that way, when you go in and start to explain exactly what cholesterol is and how actually we're really talking about lipoproteins and not this, you know, sort of imagined sludge that comes running through the bloodstream and slathers itself all over our arteries, that in fact there's these little packages being transported around the body, going to the liver and various places, and that, you know, there's a sort of reason for it happening, and that the most important message, I think, in the beginning of your book is that the reason that the cholesterol the whole concept that cholesterol causes heart disease and plaques and things like that, if you look at what cholesterol actually is and how it's transported, it suddenly actually sort of dissolves, not to use a pun, but the whole thing sort of dissolves. What is it that actually causes these plaques that people are concerned about? What is it actually made out of?
Well, it's incredibly difficult to answer that question simply, unfortunately, as you probably know.
No, it's not simple.
If you've read the book, but the plaque is a term for a thickening, a bit like I'm trying to think of an analogy, but it's like a thickening in the wall, which eventually protrudes into the what they call the lumen, and eventually restricts the blood flow. There's all sorts of things in a plaque. There's almost everything you can think of. There's white cells. There's muscle cells. There is cholesterol in there, and there are bits of lipoproteins, although it's very difficult to work out what they are. But a plaque, essentially, as far as I'm concerned, is quite a simple thing. It represents an area where the artery was damaged. From the inside, if you like, where the lining of the artery was stripped off, and then a small blood clot forms over that point. The blood clot is then, if you like, healed. New lining grows over it, and in most cases, that small what they call a lesion is the medical term for it, is got rid of. And quite a lot of the things that you see happening in the artery, what's it called, inflammation, white cell infiltration and all these things, is essentially a response to injury. So the artery wall is injured and then repair occurs. But over time, if you have repeated episodes of injury, more and more blood clots form over that point, and gradually the repair mechanisms can't get rid of all the detritus, and eventually you get, you know, like a lesion, which would be something like a boil on the skin or something like that, just full of gunk and goo and bits and pieces. But of course, you don't want those things sticking into your arteries. But that, in the simplest case, is how I believe that the plaque or the narrowing or the damaging thing occurs. And these things are operating through all stages of, from just a small blip in the artery to a very serious kind of gunky, inflammatory, nasty thing that can eventually effectively rupture, and then you get a huge blood clot, and then basically that's the end game, if you like.
When people are examined or autopsies are performed on people who have had some kind of event, and they've looked at the clots, and my memory is that they don't find much in the way of cholesterol. They find inflammatory cells, which is kind of what you just said. But there's another important issue, which is what actually causes people to die when all of this happens. Because when we had you on the show some time back, what you said was the actual event that's supposed to cause a lack of oxygen to the blood actually seems to happen after the heart attack is over or something. It doesn't follow exactly the way people think it or have thought it did.
Well, this is the ultimate heresy, which I'm not entirely sure about. I mean, the idea is very simple, is that basically, I mean, most people would say that what happens is you've got a plaque in your artery, and it's a kind of sticky, outy thing, and eventually that, if you like, the word is ruptures, that releases a lot of gunk from inside it. That causes a blood clot to form. The blood clot itself blocks an entire artery, and if that artery is supplying a bit of blood to your heart, then that part of the heart will effectively be starved of oxygen and will infarct. And that's a very simplistic kind of plumbing approach, which most people will tell you is absolutely the correct way that this occurs. I'm sure in some cases we seem to see that, but it's remarkable. You can quite often find people's hearts have got infarcted areas in them, and you can't find a clot. Equally, an autopsy study in Holland found that young people with no previous heart disease who came in and died of a heart attack, they then had a look at their arteries and found that really in almost 5 to 10% of cases you could find this sequence of events was blood clot, blockage, infarction. But in an awful lot, the blockage had occurred weeks before and had cleared, and then the infarction happened several weeks after you'd had the blood clot formed. In some cases, there's no blood clot to find. So clearly, it's what's actually happening in the heart is much more complicated and difficult to understand than just this very simple block, you know, infarct death kind of scenario, which is the one that's presented. And there are people, and I've been reading what they're saying, that saying essentially that the heart muscle will infarct, or as some people call this, dying, but it obviously doesn't die because it doesn't turn into a blackened piece of necrotic tissue. It turns into scar tissue. But leaving that aside, what's happening is clearly if you put heart muscle under enough stress, then it just says, I can't cope anymore, and decides to convert itself into either hibernating or scar tissue. So it's really a fascinating process going on in the heart, and it's far from simple. And we've been given an incredibly simplistic view of how you know, cholesterol sticks to arteries and then they narrow and then they block and then you die, and if you scrape the arteries out, we'll all be fine. It really is that human bodies are far more incredibly complicated and a sophisticated piece of machinery than that.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K. His book is The Great Cholesterol Con, not to be confused with another book written in the U.S. This book says The Great Cholesterol Con by Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, The Truth About What Really Causes Heart Disease and How to Avoid It. So the key word here is stress, and we're going to get back to that. But I want people to keep that word in their head, because that's a much better explanation for what is happening in their cardiovascular system is a response to stress. But what happens to our health statistics if pharmaceutical companies get their wish and everybody starts taking statins to lower their cholesterol to the new allowable limits, which are beyond low? I mean, they're like around 140 now here. For here, it's different measurement here in the UK. What happens to people? What happens to our health if that happens?
Well, I think my own view, and I have people write to me all the time telling me their lives have been destroyed in one way or another by taking statins. And it's clear to an extent that the more that you lower the cholesterol level, we'll call it cholesterol level even though there is no such thing, but it's a simple shorthand, if you like. And trying to reach these targets means people being put on very high doses of a substance which you've got to remember is discovered as a poison in red yeast rice, which was produced by this plant in order to kill predators. So you're giving people a dose which is getting close to the what I call the LD50, which is lethal dose 50%. No, I mean to an extent that's not true, but we are closing in on quite a high level of a very poisonous substance, essentially, which blocks a whole series of vital pathways in the liver and other cells. You don't just block cholesterol synthesis. I mean, if you think of a pathway a bit like a tree, maybe that's not a good analogy, but essentially it is a tree. It grows up, and then you have bigger branches and little branches. And at the end of one of these branches is cholesterol being synthesized in the liver. At the other end of other branches, you've got other things. You've got one of the most important is probably a substance called coenzyme Q10, which is a critical substance for energy production in cells. That's being blocked. I mean, that's such a critical substance that when Merck first put the patent together for lovastatin, they actually put in a patent application to provide coenzyme Q10 along with the statin in order to overcome the problems of coenzyme Q10 depletion. They didn't act on that patent, but they clearly knew that this was a problem very early on. And if you deplete coenzyme Q10, you cause muscle weakness, you cause all sorts of weakness throughout the body. So people become de-energized, if you like, to a greater or lesser degree. And there's all sorts of other quite important substances, and I don't know how quite important, vitally important substances that you're blocking. So this whole pathway is being blocked at a very early stage. And most of the side effects that you see are a direct result of these blockages. And increasingly, people have been looking at cholesterol metabolism in the brain and finding that if you block cholesterol metabolism in the brain, you do serious damage here. You cause glial cells, which are the primary cell in the brain, to develop into adult mature cells in one direction, and you block the production of synapses, because synapses in the brain, which are obviously the things that create memories and thoughts, are almost entirely made of cholesterol. So you're doing really, really fundamental, serious things inside the body. Luckily, the body's pretty good at overcoming a lot of these things, but in the end, if you go for lower and lower targets and higher doses of statins, people are just going to suffer an increasingly huge burden of side effects, some of which are irreversible.
You know, I have to tell you that this is, in my experience, I've read a lot of books about the issues around cholesterol. One of them is your friend, Ufi Ravenskov, your friend and associate, who reviews all of the research that's been done on cholesterol. But this book that you've written, in my estimation, is the best book so far on this issue, and that the only people who have come close to writing about this as clearly, you know, explaining the science in not only a very entertaining and funny, you're extremely funny, you're not being funny today, you're being serious, but yeah, your book is hysterical. I was reading it and laughing out loud. I read the whole book. Very beautifully written. But the point is that you explain the science and you enable people who are reading the book to follow you along and understand why it isn't physiologically possible for cholesterol to be the culprit here, and that it's a far more complicated problem, and that the body does what it does for a reason. So the only people I've seen do this before are people like Mary Innick, whose books are very hard to read, who is a lipid researcher. These are the people who usually talk about this in the correct way. So, yeah, I mean, getting rid of cholesterol is extremely harmful because all of your sex hormones are produced out of cholesterol. Your lung surfactant, the surface of your lung, is made out of cholesterol. Your brain works using phospholipids, which are what actually cholesterol is carried in. And you can't actually function. People get higher incidence of cancer. There's some sense that cancer is associated with lowering cholesterol to lower your immune system. According to UFI, there's been many research projects that show that the when cholesterol is lowered to the levels that the pharmaceutical companies are asking us to lower it to, that people's immune systems crash because they can't function without the cholesterol, and that people have extremely high rates of depression, which is also associated with heart attacks. So that actually heart attack risk goes up when cholesterol goes down.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, yes, of course, I agree. It's a fantastic book. But, no, I mean, I am being serious. I mean, I've become hugely, I mean, I'm very serious about this. I wrote the book to be funny in order that people would turn a few pages and think, well, this is not too bad to read, this scientific stuff.
Oh, it's wonderful to read.
And, well, thank you. But the problem is, of course, then people will tend to dismiss you as being just a, you know, too flippant, you know, and I have people say, said, oh, we're far too flippant about something so serious. You know, and the whole thing to me is gigantically serious, but I mean, in the end, you have to have a bit of gallows humor about it all, because otherwise I think I would just frankly go mad. I mean, I look at this and I think, hopefully in about 3 months' time, people will look back and say, we did what? We thought cholesterol was damaging and dangerous. You know, how on earth could we have been so stupid? I mean, it's more likely, unfortunately, to be in 10 or 15 years. I mean, there's a very recent study come out. I don't know if you've seen it. It's only in the last day.
About the children?
The SEAS study, which is another Vytorin study, which is showing absolutely no benefit at all, but has actually shown a significant increase in cancer risk. I mean, of all the problems that statins may cause, this is the one that worries me the most, because, you know, what they say is, oh, we haven't seen any significantly increased risk of cancer in the major studies. And you'd have to say yes, but most of these studies were done in relatively young people over a five-year period. If you did a study of people smoking over a five-year period in relatively young people, you would not see a significant increase in cancer in these people. But the fact that we are actually seeing signs of increased cancer rates, there's a major Japanese study that no one ever mentions called JLIT, where actually they provided a warning where they said the people who had the most extreme hyper-responsive drops in their cholesterol level had a 350% increased risk of dying of cancer on the statin.
Wow.
So wherever you look, you see these things appearing. In all the animal studies that they did, they found that statins increased the risk of cancer. So it seems incredibly blasé, or is that the right word? I'm not sure. It might be idiotic, might be the right word, of people just to say, oh, well, you know, we've only seen a few signs of this and most of the studies haven't shown it and let's forget it. I mean, if the cigarette manufacturers had come out with this story, we'd be screaming blue murder. I mean, yet somehow or other, statins have reached this sort of status of hallowed wonder drug that can do no harm. And people just dismiss any possible downsides as if you are somehow an unbeliever or something, and you should be taken in front of the Spanish Inquisition and burnt at the stake for daring to question the wonderfulness of them. It's become an irrational kind of situation, in my opinion.
Well, here, as I believe it is, to some extent in the UK, the pharmaceutical companies are, I think, the richest, maybe, I don't know, they're sort of neck and neck with the oil companies. Last time I looked, they were ahead of the oil companies in terms of being the richest industry. So they have enormous political clout, or clot, actually. But one of the ways that we know that cholesterol is important for human development and protective is the studies on people who don't have enough of it. And so that's all covered in the book. I don't want to get bogged down. But, you know, the other thing that's interesting is I'm hesitating because I want to mention also that when we were talking about cholesterol blocking the arteries and you start talking about endothelium injury and blood clots, it's very interesting to note in the book that vitamin C, which we no longer make in our bodies, wild animals do, we don't, our cats and dogs don't either, protects you from getting blood clots. Very simple thing to do, take vitamin C, I would say. So that's very interesting. And one of the most alarming clotting factors which can occur, and you explain why it occurs later. The previous idea was that this occurred because of genetic susceptibilities, and now what you're bringing up is it's not, it has, the damage is being done by stress, and it's a variety of different stressors, but that lipoprotein A, capital L, capital P, small a, this is caused also, you know, it's called by, caused by stress, and is also controlled by vitamin C in the diet. I mean, it's just, you know, taking vitamin C, such an easy, cheap thing to do, so much cheaper than statins, and indeed not harmful. The other thing that's alarming is in this country, they're starting to talk about giving statins to children 8 years old to lower their cholesterol. So there goes your brain development. I mean, that's just out the window at that point. I'd like you, for just a couple of minutes, because we need to break in just a couple of minutes, I'd like you to say a word about low-fat diets and cholesterol, lowering cholesterol and diet, because I know how you feel.
Well, if there's anything more stupid than the cholesterol high, well, the sort of cholesterol causes heart disease hypothesis, it's that low-fat diet is in some way good for you. I mean, you've had Gary Taubes' book out in the States. I don't know how many people have read it, but, I mean, for an awful long time, it's clear that fat, well, first of all, fat has no impact on what they call bad cholesterol levels in your blood. Of course, as far as I'm concerned, that's irrelevant because bad cholesterol or LDL is irrelevant. But this whole idea of low-fat diet is complete mythology. As you know, it started with a guy called Ansel Keys in the late 50s who went around a whole bunch of countries in the world and said, oh, look, people who eat low-fat diets, specifically low-saturated fat diets, are protected against heart disease. As an example of the world's most bogus study, I think this one gets the gold medal. He had data from seven countries. He had data from 22 countries. If you look at the data from all 22 countries, there's absolutely no correlation between saturated fat in the diet and heart disease. And in fact, I've done the more recent study done in worldwide called Monica, run by the World Health Organization. If there's one thing that is an absolute standout, it is that the countries with the lowest saturated fat consumption have by far the highest rates of heart disease. And that would be countries such as Ukraine and most of the Eastern European countries, actually. And the countries such as France, Belgium, and the Netherlands in Europe, who eat more than twice as much saturated fat, have, on average, one-seventh the rate of heart disease. So we're talking completely and utterly contradictory information here. And the whole hypothesis is just nonsense, because physiologically it doesn't make any sense. And the epidemiological evidence completely contradicts it. So of all the stupid things that have been promoted to improve our health, it is a low-fat diet.
So it's very important that people heard what you said. What you said was that in all of the research that's been done, where they go back and they look at all these different countries who are eating low-fat diets, the low-fat diets are increasing the rate of heart disease, and the people with the high-fat diets have less heart disease. So I'll leave you with that thought. We need a brief break here. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. We're on the phone today with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K. His book is The Great Cholesterol Con, The Truth About What Really Causes Heart Disease and How to Avoid It. And if you look on the web or something to try to find the book, there are two books. One is by Malcolm Kendrick and another is by somebody else. So look for the Kendrick book, because this is the one that I think is quite brilliant. I don't know about the other one. Haven't read it yet. So we're going to take a brief break. I'm Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness. I urge you to please stay with us. We're going to come back to our interview about heart disease, the real cause, in just a minute or so.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is there's nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money.
Money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that waits the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just the phrase. For it's money makes the world go round.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm here on the phone with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K, his book, The Great Cholesterol Con, The Truth About What Really Causes Heart Disease and How to Avoid It. Malcolm, I don't think you have a website, do you?
No, I'll probably have it shut down by the... if I did... I do some writing on. There was an online magazine called Red Flags Weekly, which although it unfortunately the chap who set it up unfortunately died, but some of the articles are available there. I think you'll find if you type in Malcolm Kendrick into the internet, a whole series of rabid anti-statin, anti-cholesterol articles.
Yeah, it's frothing at the mouth. Yeah. Just to let people know also, I will be doing a day-long workshop this coming Saturday at the Point Reyes Dance Palace with Edward S.B. Brown. It's going to be called Health from the Ground Up. It's day-long, and there's information on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or you can call our information number at 707-874-2772. And as always, there's also information on our website about everything that you're hearing and a full hour version of the show. So we've established that cholesterol is not the likely cause, or it's never been shown to be a cause. In fact, when we've looked at the overall effect of on morbidity and of statins, if you look overall, certainly absolutely no help for women. There's some controversy about whether there's help for men, but when you look at the overall effect on death, they don't help at all, probably because they cause other other types of death.
Well, I think this is the, I have this constant argument, even within, there is a group called the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics, which does have a website, www.thinks.org. Where other researchers and doctors write articles saying that basically it's all complete nonsense and cholesterol is completely healthy and our obsession with this substance has led to a sort of a complete madness. But I think the thing with statins is that as I say to people when they talk about events prevented or lives saved, even when you start to use these terms, it's very misleading, because the idea that you're saving a life suggests a sort of lifelong benefit, if you like. So I have spent quite a lot of time, I've written in a couple of journals in the BMJ, saying that when they say 10,000 lives may be prevented, 10,000 cardiovascular deaths may be prevented, or 10,000 lives may be saved, to say, well actually, no, 10,000 people might, and the very most extreme benefit range of these drugs be extended for a few months. When I worked the figures out, and I had to use some models, basically what you can say is that men who've had a previous heart attack taking statins in the clinical trial, there is a what they call an overall mortality benefit. In other words, you will live longer. But how large is that benefit? And when you work the figures, if you'd say that if you took a statin for 30 years, if you were a man in the very highest risk group, you may expect to gain between 3 and 4 months of increased life expectancy. When you present the figures in that way, most people go, well, what's the point of that then? To which my reply is, well, I'll leave it up to you. I'm just telling you the truth of what this benefit means in reality. But you're quite right to point out that in none of the studies done on statins, has life expectancy been increased by 1 day in women, no matter what their underlying risk is. But the way that the figures are presented, it's like the world's most dodgy secondhand car salesman. It's and I remember seeing a joke about a man selling a car to an old woman, and it's got a sign on the window saying nine careful owners, and the car's all smashed to bits really, and the woman's looking at it somewhat dubiously, and the car salesman says, "Ah, yes, but the tenth owner wasn't that bothered."
Say that again.
The tenth owner wasn't that bothered.
The tenth owner wasn't that bothered.
Nine careful owners and one non-careful owner. With the statins, you get this kind of 30% reduction in cardiovascular mortality. And everyone goes, whoopee, as if somehow 30% of people's lives are going to be saved. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, once you actually say to them, yes, but what does that mean? If I took this drug for the next 30 years of my life, as I haven't had a previous heart attack, how much longer can I expect to live? And boy, will they not answer that question for you, because the answer is, you won't live any longer.
You may also have your life shortened by the use of the statin because of their other effects.
Well, I think that if you take a statin for 30 years, you probably will have your life shortened, because these long-term effects, such as cancer causation and liver function problems, will gradually build up over a lifetime, and you'll just die of one of these things. I can't say that, because no one's done a 30-year study.
But we do.
Problems emerging, and you think, well, in my view, if you are a woman, or you're a man who hasn't got pre-existing heart disease, there is no point in taking these drugs. All they will do is change what's written on your death certificate. As it wasn't Mary Enig, but it was one of her colleagues said, you know, if you take a statin, it will change what's written on your death certificate, but it will not change the date. So what's the point? And a BMJ article I just quoted recently said that, you know, especially in the elderly, if you take a statin, all that happens is that you swap dying of heart disease for dying of cancer. And frankly, I think I'd rather die of heart disease than cancer, but maybe other people have a different view on that. So, I mean, they are the world's most pointless drugs. They have been unbelievably hyped. The wool has been pulled over what seems to be almost everybody's eyes, and just to an incredible extent, to a mind-boggling extent, that I just look on and think, well, the world has gone collectively bonkers. I'm just going to wait until they regain their sanity, and then I can parade around the world with a big banner saying, "I told you so," for the next 30 years of my life.
We look forward to that. The reason I mentioned that you might die earlier is that all of the morbidity, early death studies on elderly people over 65, all of them, and you have all this research cited in your book. But what shows over and over and over again, and these are really big studies, I mean like 51,000 people, that kind of thing, is that people with the highest cholesterol levels, no matter what the LDL ratio to HDL, whatever that nonsense is, all the people with the highest cholesterol levels are the ones that live the longest. So if you're driving your cholesterol down, you're likely to kill yourself. The other thing is that when I interviewed Duane Gravelines, who you mentioned in the book, The Astronaut, who wrote several books about statins and about their effect on the brain and how it, you know, sort of gets, you sort of lose your brain function, your cognitive function. What he said is that since he's a physician, is that men with previous heart events, he will give them a dose that is microscopic compared to what's being given out, maybe 5 milligrams instead of 80. So he's saying, you know, these can be used and have some effect, but you have to use these microscopic doses. That's all you need to do it. Now, that brings me to the next topic, which is what actually causes death. And one of the things that's interesting is that since the overall effect on morbidity is the longest-lived people with the ones with the high cholesterol, so we might mention here that that's only true if their blood sugar was under control. So this brings us to our next topic, which is who gets heart attacks and why, or stress kills?
Well, I think it's difficult to provide a simple answer to this, because, I mean, there are no doubt other things that are at play here. As you mentioned, blood sugar, although, as you know from the book, I believe that losing control of your blood sugar is a secondary result of
We agree with that.
Yeah. But also, I mean, smoking definitely plays a role in heart disease. If you smoke, you increase your risk by a factor of three.
Do you want to explain how that is, why it is, what it is that cigarette smoke does to the heart?
Well, it obviously people, I know in the UK they have an advert showing cigarettes with somebody smoking it, there's sort of fat dripping at the end, and saying when you smoke a cigarette, each time you smoke a cigarette, fat is deposited in your arteries. And you do feel like asking the very simple question, well, how many molecules of fat does a cigarette contain? So how exactly does the fat from a cigarette get deposited in your arteries? Clearly, obviously, when you think about it, that's nonsense. But what I believe is happening with cigarettes is that cigarettes trigger the release of various chemicals. If you smoke a cigarette, what it does is it activates your stress response in your brain, specifically the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is a little bit of gunk that sits in your brain that warns you when you're about to be attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. A cigarette gives you a little message saying you're about to be attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. This triggers a stress response in the system. It causes the arteries to narrow. It causes the blood sugar to rise. It causes adrenaline and all these other chemicals to be released into your bloodstream. And all of these things attack the lining of your arteries and thus allow damage to occur. Smoking also increases blood clotting factors. It increases the clotting factors by a huge amount very quickly.
Can I just say that another way, and you tell me if I've got it right?
Right, sorry.
Is it the case that the chemicals and the actual smoke itself are causing, as you say, the body to go into a fight-or-flight response? So is it correct to say that pollutants and chemicals also cause a fight-or-flight response in the human body?
Well, I think they certainly do. I mean, the human body is a pretty, unfortunately, quite a sensitive creature. You slap things into it, and it reacts, and it quite often reacts in a defense mechanism mode and fires up various fight-or-flight responses. And I think that these things, if they are just repeated insults into your system, gradually build up problems. So I'm sure that if you add, cigarette smoking causes heart disease, stress causes heart disease, you start adding factors in like pollution and other things to make it your body system is less good at repairing and less able to repair itself, and problems occur. Because, as you know, one of the things that I've written about in the book is the fact that the lining in your arteries, how that is repaired and replaced, is by cells that wander around in your bloodstream called progenitor cells. They're produced in the bone marrow. And if you knock down the production of progenitor cells, then the repair of the arteries is seriously compromised. And in people who have these very low progenitor cell levels, heart disease progresses very rapidly. And there are a number of things that can do this, from steroid use, which knock these things down, problems with the kidney function, and that's another association with pollutants and damaging substances, as they affect the kidneys. The kidneys are affected. The kidneys fail to send messages to the bone marrow to say produce repair substances. And when you get damage created, the repair system doesn't work properly, and you end up with an accelerated plaque growth, if you like, in the arteries.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K, in the UK. He is the author of The Great Cholesterol Con. Again, please, if you look for this book, do look for the one by Malcolm Kendrick, because that is who you're hearing interviewed. There are two books with that name. And, Jeffrey, you had something?
Oh, we have a link to the book on our site.
Oh, on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. So, the thing that's what you're saying is that there are many reasons to have a stress response in the body, one not the least of which is to challenge the body's ability to repair itself by hurling various chemicals and pollutants. And it's just sort of loading on the side of the seesaw with a bunch of things that are damaging and cause inflammation and damage and whatnot like that. And then on the other side, there's just not a whole lot of other stuff to balance it out. So off you go to clotting. I know that you do not like the genetic theory of heart disease, although we are, and I don't either, I have to say, because genetics, you know, respond to the environment. And of course, what we're saying here is that that these gene expressions are turned on and off by the environment. And if the environment is crap, then you're going to have a gene response and presentation of effects that are going to be problematic. But we do see sort of things, variants occur in family lines because of a history of stress and trauma in the family and pollutants and whatnot. And I have noticed more recently, and I don't know how you feel about this, that there is more of an effect on the way that people metabolize certain heart protective nutrients like folic acid, and I do feel that adding in those things like CoQ10, carnitine, folic acid, B12, so that the liver can do its job and maybe help with this pollutant load. But that doesn't stop the problem of stress. And it's interesting to notice in your book, the studied groups, you know, comparing the different studied groups in terms of who's getting lots of heart attacks and what kinds of lives they're leading. So do you want to talk about differences in countries and their diets and their behaviors?
Well, I think it's partly behaviors. I mean, what's interesting, what's fascinating is clearly that the heart disease in Western Europe, for instance, has been dropping since the 1970s. The exact date of the 1970s would be difficult to put because it's been different in different countries. Whereas in Eastern Europe, the rates of heart disease have just been going stratospheric. If you look at the standard risk factors, and in fact the MONICA study from the World Health Organization has done this, and in very small print, very carefully mentioned, is that they can't find any association between the rates of heart disease in these countries and the traditional risk factors. But I just looked at these countries and I asked myself to a certain extent, well, what's happening in them? I think the first country that I looked at and had no idea what was happening in it was Finland. And at one time in the early 60s, Finland had the highest rate of heart disease in the world. It was stratospheric. I think it was higher than any country has ever been before or since. And I thought, well, Finland seems like a nice, gentle, quiet little country in Scandinavia. I can't believe that there's been an enormous upheaval in these people's lives. I can't quite see what's caused the huge degree of stress. So I then went and tried to find out the history of Finland and discovered that after the Second World War, in 1948, 600,000 people were moved out of what was traditionally a bit of Finland by the Russians. And forcibly evicted and shifted back out of their homes into Finland, primarily into an area called Karelia or North Karelia. And this has been described as the largest forced migration of people in the history, proportionately, because Finland's quite a small country, proportionately the largest forced migration of a group of people in history. And I thought, well, that kind of changes my view of how much stress these people were under. So there was a hugely stressful, enormous uprooting event occurred in the late 1940s. And between 10 and 15 years later, the heart disease rate in this country was stratospheric, and it has fallen ever since. So I thought, well, what other populations have been put under enormous, if you like, social stress? And one group that sprang to mind was Australian Aboriginals. It is a group that basically were uprooted from their traditional lifestyles. They have been, if you like, although they haven't moved from Australia, their lives have been hugely disrupted, breakdown of social structures, and the Australian Aboriginals now, I think, as of today, have the highest rate of heart disease in the world. I stand to be corrected on that, but it is approximately 25 times that age matched as in a country like France. So I then looked around at other countries and said, well, which other countries have been undergoing enormous upheaval? And if you look at Eastern Europe, when the wall came down after the after communism broke up in 1987 or whenever it was exactly, the heart disease rate was high, but after that it exploded. In a period of 4 years, the life expectancy in Russia fell by 6 years. the vast majority of that was accounted for by increased risk of death from heart disease. And when you read about what was going on in Eastern Europe and Russia at that time, it was a gigantic social upheaval. People's lives were being turned upside down, and basically it was an incredibly stressful and difficult time. And at that time, if you look across Europe, you can see Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Czech Republic, their heart disease rates just exploded. So I thought, well, this is not coincidence. Because, of course, interestingly to me was that Poland was the first of the Eastern European countries, if you like, to become or move into the democracy. But in fact, their heart disease rate went up before anywhere else in Eastern Europe, and it started to fall before anywhere else in Eastern Europe followed this pattern. So to me, wherever you looked, if you saw really hugely high rates of heart disease exploding, then you said, well, what happened? And when I look back at the United States, I mean, clearly in the United States there was an enormous migration to the United States and during the sort of early part of the 20th century with millions and millions and tens of millions of migrant families moving in. And the heart disease rate in America went stratospheric about 20 to 30 years later, peaking, I believe, in about 1950 and then falling ever since. So to me, a clear pattern was emerging of social upheaval, social destruction, destruction of social networks, followed closely by an enormous explosion in the rate of heart disease. And you can find this in population after population around the world. This pattern emerges.
You know, one thing that I was also thinking about, along with groups of people, the thing that's interesting about the Aboriginals is that they tend to be thin and not have high cholesterol levels and all that, and yet they have this high heart disease. So that's very clear. But one thing that I want you to, I'm just looking at how much time we have left. One thing I wanted you to clear up is this whole, you know, there's all these paradoxes about why do the French get to do whatever they want and have a good time and have low heart disease anyway, and that it's a paradox. And then we have the Asians, and the Asians are not a paradox. They're supposed to be an example to the rest of us. But I always find this ironic because Asians actually haven't got terrific health. I mean, the stress levels in Japan with the workers is very high, although they have a very different social network there. But you talk a little bit about Asians and what protects them and what doesn't, and it's not apparently just green tea.
Well, no, I mean, obviously you have to look at different groupings. What's interesting is that what we call in Europe is like Indian Asians from India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, that area of the world. Wherever they move to, they end up with enormously high rates of heart disease. Many of these people are vegetarian, so you can't really blame the diet because they don't have the diet. Most of them don't smoke. Rates of smoking are very low. My view is very clear, is that these people have uprooted themselves from one society, moved across the world. Many of them are living in very different, in some cases, many of them are viewed as somewhat alien and different. And I think their social networks are very difficult to maintain and create. I think these people are under a lot of stress. And as you rightly point out, they very often have low LDL levels, cholesterol levels. They very often are not overweight. In fact, they're very often much less, lower what they call body mass indexes. And if you look at all of their theoretical risk factors, they're really theoretically rather good. And yet, their rates of heart disease are astronomical.
Right, and in all these Asian groups, we do see a lot of metabolic disruption, you know, a lot of the sort of high blood sugar, these symptoms of metabolic disruption caused by stress, too.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that, I mean, to me, the as you know, if you've read the book, is quite straightforward. If you cause long-term chronic stress, this upsets the metabolism because you have high levels of sympathetic nervous system activity, high levels of stress hormones in the body continuously. This creates a situation whereby you get peripheral resistance to insulin, so the fat buildup occurs centrally. This central obesity leads to problems with the liver function, insulin resistance, and eventually raised blood sugar levels, along with a whole spectrum of things like low HDL, high VLDL, high lipoprotein A, high insulin levels, high sugar levels, et cetera, et cetera. You name it. You name a bad thing, you've got it. And you can see this pattern emerging in these groups of people. So very clearly to me, the pattern is prolonged chronic disruptive stress creates central obesity and all the other concomitant problems of the metabolic syndrome come along with that. And in fact, a Swedish researcher called Bjorntorp did a lot of work in this area and basically showed that people who were under stress and who were depressed developed all of these metabolic abnormalities. And in fact, he did a study showing that people who became severely depressed actually developed what he defined as type 2 diabetes. And when the depression got better, the type 2 diabetes went. So you can see that the very powerful effects of long-term, what I call stress is not really the right word, long-term disruption of the neurohormonal system creates measurable and chronic problems with your entire metabolism. And these things then go on to kill you, because all of these things are potentially increase your blood coagulation, your chance of your blood clotting, damage your arteries, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, there's a very clear pattern. In fact, if you look, it stares you directly in the face and shouts, hello, I'm here, look at me. Because if you do decide to look at it, you can't miss it. It's like being shown these pictures where you either see a picture of a beautiful woman or an old woman, depending on how you view it. As far as I'm concerned, everyone is seeing this picture of cholesterol, whereas if you view it in another way, you see stress. And once you've seen it, you can't believe other people won't see it or can't see it. That it's like saying to somebody, there's a tree, and they're saying, no, there isn't. It's as clear and obvious as that to me and to many other people.
Well, the two interesting things, people always ask me, what raises cholesterol? How do I get my cholesterol down? What raises my cholesterol? And the answer is two things, stress. And this is, you know, particularly noticeable if you go in to have a cholesterol test and you're just coming down with a cold. It'll be astronomical. And the other is eating too much sugar. So, yes, you're right. It is pretty obvious. We're just about out of time, but it sounds like the main message of the book is take care of yourself, enjoy your life, and try to recover from stress.
Well, I think one of my main messages would be anything that you enjoy is good for you. And don't be frightened of all these stupid messages that people are coming out with and trying to make you fearful of your health.
Okay.
Because health is about enjoyment and smiling and having fun and having a good close circle of friends and all of these things that make you feel good. The things that make you feel good are good for you.
Thank you.
And that would be my main message of life, really.
Okay. Thank you so much, Malcolm Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K, The Great Cholesterol Con. Thank you so much for the time you gave us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. I hope maybe one or two people will
pick up the book.
Life for the better.
Yeah, and pick up the book. Thank you.
Okay.
And I want to thank you all for listening. And a brief reminder, I'll be doing a day-long workshop this Saturday at the Point Reyes Dance Palace with Edward S.B. Brown. There's information on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or you can call our information number 707-874-2772. And remember, there's information about everything about your own health and fitness at yourownhealthandfitness.org. And there's information as well on sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.